Hello and welcome to another edition of the Predator Podcast, the show where we help business leaders navigate through the choppy waters of the IT technology landscape. I'm Al McKenzie, CEO of Predator, and each week I'm going to be joined by guests who've experienced some of the journeys that you are all going on as channel leaders. With me today, I've got Mark Sampson and Doug Sawyers. So let me introduce, first of all, Mark Sampson. Mark is the founder and CEO of Belief, a leading organizational identity practice. Mark specializes in helping ambitious services companies to separate themselves from their competition by codifying what makes them different, distinctive, and desirable. Welcome, Mark.
Great to be here.
Also with me today is Doug. He's Doug Sawyers. He's the non-executive director of Predator and brings nearly 30 years of board experience from the HR, travel, and B2B business services sectors. He's run businesses for over 20 years, including overseeing the transition to SaaS and the development of new business and commercial models. Welcome, Doug.
Thanks, Al. Nice to be here.
So, Mark, let's start with you then. So, interesting bio. I noticed on your LinkedIn profile that you describe yourself as an idea junkie, instigator, energizer, helping companies articulate who they are and why they matter. So I'm curious. My first question, Mark, is why is it people see themselves or explain themselves perhaps in a different light on social media compared to formal bios? I much prefer your LinkedIn bio. It's much more exciting. Talk me through that.
I think for LinkedIn in particular, LinkedIn for me is about what is the benefit that you're going to be providing to whoever you're going to be working with. And so I think probably on a company bio perspective, when you're describing what your company does, it might be slightly different to what you do as an individual. I suppose you can kind of mash the two things together. Ultimately, my work is about, we live in a very, very saturated world, an over-communicated world. And so as an organization today, particularly a services-based organization, if you're in a saturated sector, there's plenty of competition, there's loads of people doing what you're doing. How do you make yourself distinctive? How do you make yourself stand out?
Yeah, and Mark, you talk on your website about the finding that magic 10% that makes you different, the thing that is, I guess, authentic to you, differentiates you. Why is it that, you know, channel leaders today in particular, or any businesses for that matter, why is it they find it so hard to find that magic 10% that really differentiates them and helps them be unique in the marketplace?
I think when you're running a business, often like you're so in it that it's really, really hard to kind of take that step back, you know, have a reflective viewpoint and start to understand what is it that actually makes us tick and separate us from the competition. And I think it's probably one of the hardest things to do as a leader. And we often kind of end up, you know, using terms that everyone else is using, and we default to things like, oh yeah, we offer great customer service, or we really care about our people. And actually these things do nothing to differentiate. They actually are kind of the same as what everyone else is saying. So I think when you're in a business, it's hard to kind of get that different perspective. And that's why I think, you know, having maybe some external counsel just to have a different view on your business and talk to your employees and talk to your customers and to understand their view on what makes you great as an organization can often help.
Yeah, and I've had first-hand experience of Mark's guidance and counsel in there, and I can truly vouch for his value-added qualities. But we want to come back to some of the things that Mark touched on there, and we will do that. We'll come back to that. But let's not forget my other guest, Doug Sawyers. So, Doug, some interesting things about you. You've been in HR most recently, but in tech. But tell us about your experiences with Tough Mudder, because I'm interested in that, because with HR, obviously you were working for a technology company.
Yeah.
And yet from a team building point of view and advancing a business's corporate team atmosphere and performance, you know, how do you balance that experience of doing Tough Mudder with, here you go, here's a tech platform that all your HR issues will be solved? That's probably according to the HR salesman. Can you tell us a bit about the company that you work for and how you balance that?
With pleasure. So the company I worked with at the time is called Ceridian, and we were a HR technology provider and an outsourcer, and in the midst of transforming from old world to SaaS, actually. And very important to us all the way through the time there was colleague engagement. And we also had, part of that was raising money actually for our own charity within the business. We didn't, I mean, it's great to give money to charities, but our people come up with the idea of having our own charity. So we regularly, we combine these things by holding events, and we try to involve as many of our people as possible in each of these fundraisers. The company had about 900, 1,000 people, but Tough Mudder, not everybody in the business can attend a Tough Mudder, but we managed to get 1 year 70 out of the 1,000 people performing a Tough Mudder somewhere in the UK, and even did an equivalent thing out in Mauritius. It wasn't called Tough Mudder. Fantastic for team engagement, colleague engagement. If people didn't participate, then many of them came to watch, and lots of them looked for support from their colleagues in terms of raising money. If those of us that went through Tough Mudder, I'm not sure we enjoyed the experience, but we did love the team aspect, because some people do Tough Mudder and they do it for themselves. We were sort of doing it for the team, and we were able to video what we were doing, and we took many pictures, and we used that afterwards to just recall what the experience felt like and how essentially people helped each other. Because Al, you've done Tough Mudder too, and you know that some of it's physical, but a lot of it's mental. And if you have a friend or a colleague encouraging you to jump 15 feet into a deep pool of freezing cold water, and you're not feeling quite like doing that, then your friends can coax you into doing that. And you feel that bond afterwards, which is a warming experience. So we brought that back into our business. The first big Tough Mudder we did made an enormous difference to the enthusiasm with which people went after team engagement. And we brought that to our customers as well. We used that part of our company's profile in the way we communicated with our customers. Our customers were generally HR people,
yeah.
So colleague engagement was always high on their agenda, and they wanted to work with people who saw that as important in their own business.
So, Doug, as the financial director, and we talk to a lot of financial directors of CFOs of channel companies who are naturally, quite rightly, maybe nervous about making the move from transactional sales to SaaS. How is it the CEO convinced you? What did he or she say to overcome your skepticism?
Well, we went through a journey that we were private equity owned our business, and there was an urgency about making dramatic changes in the performance of the business and the value of the business. And as people saw the SaaS revolution coming fast, the chance I had to react to or lead it, and our owners and chief exec, my boss in North America, was evangelistic about the opportunities that SaaS would bring the business. And went embarked on a journey at a great pace, which effectively meant that we were bringing a different type of service product to our customer base than previously. And it was a new story. Very exciting, looked great, but I was a bit skeptical, certainly in the early days, because a lot of the technology was being written on the hoof, mm-hmm. And things were not quite, the paint wasn't quite dry on the certain elements of it. Plus, our customer acceptance was a challenge initially. We were effectively in Europe selling a product that was built from North America, and it wasn't quite in line with all European needs at the early days. However, we got through that quite quickly, and I have to say, became a fan of it. We got past the stage where your business model changes from being once-off or big investment-based, and moved towards an annuity model, more preponderance of an annuity. And we saw the sense of it just behind, I guess, our chief executive, the evangelist. And we saw the dramatic effect it had over a couple of years on the performance of our business, the reputation of our business, and most importantly, probably its future prospects, because it had been modernized comparatively overnight. And we jumped ahead of our competition and got the business into a very good place for a successful future.
Can we drill into the numbers a little bit? Because obviously a software vendor, manufacturer of software, is traditionally, especially in that transactional business model, used to astonishingly good margins of, you know, 80-85%, and, you know, effectively customers are giving you money up front for taking on the risk of operating the software, and then you get, you know, the payback every year with the maintenance SNS subscription fees. To a finance director, that's heaven, right? Mm-hmm. And whereas the SaaS world, you know, it's starting off maybe with smaller deals, revenue accrual is spread out over a long period of time. You must have been nervous about that. I mean, how did you mitigate that? And you know, have you got any stories about, you know, fights in the boardroom, for example?
Yeah, we certainly had lots of discussions and we were nervous about it. I think what helped our business, the circumstances that helped our business at the time was that we needed to change in the eyes of our private equity owners. And they were very, very persistent and quite aggressive in the style of, with which they managed their businesses. So they wanted a quick change fast, which meant that we were asked to move faster than we might naturally feel like doing. And if you're in the finance community, that felt particularly uncomfortable. And
may I say, a Scottish finance
director.
Yeah.
Yeah,
both, that must have been really tough for your Canadian CEO.
Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, the facts really of the matter is that although it feels uncomfortable, especially if you're a Scottish finance leader in that space, it's a market. And if a market's moving to SaaS and moving to annuity models and no longer big investments and high margins and going to be perhaps slimmer margins and less certainty over a recurring asset sale model, then you have to go with it. So the progressive finance leaders perhaps realize that first.
Yeah.
And look to the advantages of that model and then become evangelists of that model. And they're associated with the most successful companies in those spaces.
Have you got any hints and tips, suggestions for fellow finance professionals as to how you maybe mitigate that transition? And for example, you know, did you go all in, switch over overnight, or did you have some sort of phased plan? And how did you go about doing that?
We had a plan, which meant that we effectively sweated some of the existing stock of business and used the cash, the positive cash flow from that, to fund the development of the SaaS model. By that, really, we just stopped investment in future development of the old style. And we did less marketing of the old style. And we changed some of our people around quite significantly, brought in some different talents. All of that cost money, but we used the old account base, if you like, to fund most of it. Every company's circumstances will be different. It is easier to be a SaaS company, SaaS annuity model, if you're starting from scratch now because you don't have the heritage. If you're very successful, I've been very successful in the past and I've got a large installed base, you're going to have to move at a slower pace. And it's about trying to find the optimal route through that cash resources and time resources and people skills resources allows. And overarching all of it is at what pace is the market and are the customers prepared to accept that model too. That's probably the principal driving force behind your domestic concerns.
And, you know, for the benefit of our listeners who are mainly in the channel, they may be thinking, right, it's all good for Doug and his software vendor business, but did you have a channel at Ceridian and how did they react to your change?
We did. We found that some of our partners embraced the change themselves because they could work out for themselves. They could see the signs from the market that they had to change and evolve their own businesses to go with it. And these were the people that we'd still be partners with. Some of the others were too reluctant to accept that change was happening at the pace we could see it was. And I think some of those relationships have since been severed.
So okay,
it sounds quite blunt, but you know, the market evolves comparatively fast.
What was the value add of the channel? Did that value add that they added, double positive there, but did that change from maybe implementation to something else? What was that something else?
So the expertise in terms of knowing aspects of the local markets and their known customers were enhanced by being part of the explanation and the story of the transformation from the old world to the new. The cooperative and subsequently successful partners embraced it and came with us and were able to use their knowledge of the local conditions, you know, their customers and their sectors, their markets, to advantage of our overall corporation, which was a global corporation moving forward across many, many geographies. So we found that the more progressive channel partners really did bring some value add because they let our SaaS solution development better reflect the needs of their customers faster than those that were more reluctant to participate.
Okay, thanks, Doug. Given that we're talking about as a service, server's been the distinction. I'd like to now bring Mark into this conversation. And which is more important, Mark? Do you think software of the SaaS or the service of the SaaS?
I think if you take Amazon as an example, so I think Amazon is renowned for a really great customer experience. But how many times do we actually have to physically speak to a representative from Amazon? And so I think they've used technology to automate and to basically deliver an exceptional experience. And so, you know, I feel it depends what type of company that you are. You know, there are some organizations where, take Salesforce. I think Salesforce's approach is very much one of the first SaaS pioneers. But getting Salesforce to work out of the box, you're going to need customization. And as a result, Salesforce has got a very, very healthy channel because actually that customization is needed. So there is a huge service element to go with the implementation. So I think it really comes down to the type of company that you're looking to build. You know, are you looking to build a pure play SaaS product company? In which case, you know, can someone use your offering straight away out of the box? Or are you looking to build a services business as well and keep that in-house? Or are you looking to build a channel which will effectively deliver your professional services consultancy?
Okay, thank you, Mark. So going back to the mechanism about, you know, you're an ambitious channel CEO, you've got your CFO on board, everyone's happy, you now want to make this switch. You're used to big cash flows coming in up front, not recurring over time. How do you finance that transition? You know, what should you do? How do you decide whether you should, you know, fund it from cash reserves, from existing customers? You know, is, you know, given the low cost of borrowing mm-hmm. across the world at the moment, is it better to take on a certain amount of debt? Mm-hmm. How do you go about making those decisions as a CFO?
So my experience, the first thing is to make sure you have very accurate knowledge of where you are and what your future predictions are, and then be comparatively conservative on the success of the new model, because I think the last thing you want to do is get into a position where you're too ambitious and need to go back and ask for more cash or more cash from whichever source you're looking for it from.
So be conservative.
Be conservative because, of course you expect a finance guy to say that, but it's very easy to get it way wrong when a 5% difference in your anticipated growth rate, for example, means the difference between real success and real failure. Because when you go through into that new model, if your growth isn't where you expect it to be, you find that because of the high margins associated with SaaS, it makes an enormous difference to the cash flow on the bottom line. So what we did from personal experience was we made sure that we understood how much cash is coming in from our installed customer base. We had a high degree of accuracy in that. It was very predictable. And then we took comparatively conservative scenarios of different growth levels forward with the new SaaS offering. We made sure that we had enough in the reserves to fund a different type of marketing. We made sure we had enough in the reserves to fund a different, in some cases, type of sales force and indeed personnel. Not wholesale change, but significant investment in training because it's a different beast. And then we looked beyond that to see when the actual cash was be coming in because it's just a different profile from the history. And we're too conservative assumptions on collectability. And also we assumed that our customer attrition rate would be higher in the new regime than it was in the old.
So we expect talking about churn.
Churn. Yeah. We expected churn to increase. Now, in reality, it happens. It hasn't really happened in our experience. But we anticipated the portability of solutions to be such that people would change supplier on a more regular basis. So we took all of these conservative assumptions, but then tried to resist the temptation to go to the fairly easy money available from investment houses and self-funded through the migration of the old customer base into its new form. I think if you're a startup business, that's a completely different story because you don't have that availability of previous cash flows to dwell on. So you're modeling right from the beginning acceptable realistic growth rates. If you're an established business, really a lot depends on just how strong and how long you're going to maintain that existing cash cow, if you want to call it that, to be slightly crude in financial terms, to fund your growth forward.
Doug, you mentioned that you needed to fund a different type of marketing. We'll come back to your opinion on that, but I want to turn to Mark and say, you know, you do a lot of work with organizations in terms of positioning brands, positioning products, particularly in channel services companies. From a marketing perspective, and my experience, by the way, is that marketing is very much a distant 10th on the priority list of the typical channel CEO. You know, sales is the all dominant. Technology is dominant. Marketing is a bit of an afterthought. I'm sure you have a different opinion or different perspective on this. And you're, I think, trying to elevate marketing and put it in its rightful place in terms of the CEO's mind. What's your view on marketing in the channel and in particular how that needs to change as we move more towards technology being delivered as a service?
I think Doug's point around a different type of marketing is a really interesting one, because to be honest, if you've been a traditional VAR business, then you are a representative, effectively, you're a sales agent of someone else's product, right? And I would imagine a lot of channel leaders that are running VAR-based businesses today, you know, they're struggling with squeezed margins. Yeah, because there's always going to be, you know, another provider that can basically sell that piece of kit to that customer. And so as a channel business starts to evolve and it wants to differentiate itself, I think a real key thing today is really how do you start to build trust with an audience above and beyond just someone else's product? And so your perspective, your viewpoints, you know, your level of expertise built into your marketing, and almost treating marketing as more, you know, the ability to kind of, I suppose, educate and to inspire and to share, you know, to kind of build up, you know, customers to come to you. I think it's just a question of reframing it. You know, in the channel, you're so right. Marketing has always played second fiddle to sales, right? It's always been a sales focused approach. But I think today, you know, you look at the old tactics of marketing like outbound calling, telesales, etc. You know, how effective is that today? You know, someone will always tell you that's making those calls that it's harder than ever before. And so the question for me around marketing in today's marketplace is one of trust. How do you position yourself to build trust and rapport quickly with an audience?
And I guess as well, you know, the channel company that's moving from VAR to MSP, traditionally from a marketing perspective, they've been standing on the shoulders of the technology giants as a reseller. So they've been able to lean on that, their brands and their power in the marketplace, and sort of get in the way of the commercial flow. As they're moving to MSP, they're creating their own product brands, you know, and suddenly they're probably, or maybe they upfront realize, but that's a whole different proposition around building their own brand, you know, from scratch. I mean, Doug, from a viewpoint of that, I mean, how is that going to be financed?
Yeah, well, I think the marketing that's more aligned to that is a lot to do with reputation built through relationships reflected back in the value of those customers. So if you have a success story with your MSP customers, make sure that you capture it and milk it, and then link it to others.
You're saying, rather than saying, right, we'll take the new as a service offerings to a whole new set of customers, you're saying actually the best way to get off the ground is to attack your existing customer base.
That's where your relationships
are. But a lot of people will be fearful of cannibalizing those big upfront transactional.
It's always going to be a judgment of when and if it's appropriate to do that. But I'm working from the assumption that as things evolve and change, then those big traditional customers will become of the past. And if you want to keep them as customers, you have to evolve with them and reflect the new demands on the MSP environment that are available.
Okay.
So I would focus heavily on understanding the customer experience and how that can be translated into a strong marketing networking message, if you like. I think it's as important as, I mean, more important than any other angle of marketing. Customer communities kind of come with SaaS and a managed service provision marketplace more naturally than they did in the previous days.
Okay, so I'm the CEO of a channel company and I've succeeded in getting my chief finance officer on board. Probably the hardest job, but yeah. Get that done. The ship sailing in the right direction, all's good. Okay. The next task, and I'm looking at Mark, is who else do we need to get on board? Sales director.
Hmm.
You know? So we know how to finance it. We've got the plan, 3-5 year break-even plan on sales. What else could derail this journey from VAR to MSP? And in my experience working in the channel, the biggest hurdle, the biggest barrier is the sales director. Mark, why is it you think the sales director can be the biggest hurdle in this transformation?
I think you've already nailed it. It's those big transactional deals. Mm. Like, you know, if I've always, and my team has always made our money through big transactional deals, like, where am I going to focus? Like, you know, if I'm a sales manager, sales director, or salesman today, you know, am I going to go and focus on some transactional business that, you know, maybe is £1 million worth of kit that's going to drop 30% worth of margin, you know, and 10% into a salesman's pocket? Am I going to focus there, or am I going to go and sell a managed service contract? Right. So if you want to drive change in a business, like, the whole business needs to be behind this from the top down. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, there's an invisible force at work, and Doug touched on it earlier, you know, around the idea of culture, right? And embedded in culture is rewards, mm-hmm. you know, rewards and recognition. And actually, I think anyone looking to drive change in their business today from maybe a traditional VAR to an MSP, and they're not seeing any traction, they've got to look at their reward mechanisms, they've got to look at their policies and their practices around basically how people are getting compensated, because that's going to drive behavior.
And you can't put those rewards in place with a finance director who's not on board.
Right. That's why everyone, you know, and I think this is, and I'm sure Doug will agree, like, this is a top-down exercise. Yeah. Like, you can't set up the idea of becoming an MSP as a small, isolated science project. And, oh, let's just have a dabble and see if we get anywhere. And then, oh, look, no one's paying attention to it. So that's no good. We won't pursue it.
You cannot half do it. Yeah, you have to have that evangelical leadership from always the CEO has to be on top, right across the rest of the people. I think the sales area is always going to be most challenging because people are, with respect to some of those salespeople, used to the comparatively easy money of the transactional days. But the reality is the world's moved on and those solutions are more easy to replicate in new technology, which means the degree of complexity and difficulty from a sales perspective is reduced. And therefore, you're in a new environment where rewards have to match personal interest, of course, but what the customer is prepared to pay, and just match the ease of the sale. Whilst it's less rewarding potentially an individual sale, you can do more of them.
Is there anything a finance director can do to persuade salespeople to make this shift? I mean, let's talk about, for example, landed revenue, mm-hmm. contract value, ACV, TCV, that sort of thing, and sales commissions in particular. So it's easy for a finance director to pay a high commissions for transactional business because the cash has come in.
Yeah.
You know, they pay on invoicing or they pay on when the customer pays. You know you've got the cash.
Yeah.
But if you're selling something that's valuable to the stakeholders in the business, the shareholders in the business, you know, recurring revenue, yeah. 3-5 year contracts, but the money's not necessarily coming in. Well, unless the salesperson is a shareholder in the business, mm-hmm. they're going to say, why should I, Doug, Mr. CFO? You've got shares.
Yeah.
You're building your net worth. I've got to feed my family. I've got to pay the mortgage this month.
Exactly.
What are you going to do to help me?
Exactly. So the successful businesses in that space already have recognized that this is strategically not just important, it's an imperative. And then you have to set the business up to be able to deliver against that target, that reality, which means that you have to be honest with yourselves, Mr. Finance Directors, and make sure that the sales force are really well rewarded for the success and growth of the MSP provision. So you get the percentages of reward that are perhaps unheard of in the previous environment. You just have to face up to that. Sales and marketing costs as a percentage of revenue becomes a bigger thing than it did in the previous environment. That I know is what we've done in the past in our own business, and our reward budgets were the subjects of great controversy and great discussion. But
I love the fact you call them reward budgets, whereas salespeople would say my entitlement.
Entitlement, exactly. So it's really, really important. You've got to be honest with yourself. You can't have one part of the business all enthusiastic about the new model and that not being backed up across the critical success support functions. You have to go for it completely, which means that salespeople have to be motivated, feel excited about it, and feel they're well rewarded.
Okay, thank you, Doug. Thank you, Mark. Listen, I want to wrap up now, and I want to just get your final thoughts on something. So it doesn't have to be within a particular business that you've worked in the past. It could be anything to do with business transformation, either from the natural world or from business or sport, anything at all. And I want you to just, while I'm talking, have a think about where you've seen the biggest change in an organization, in a person, in a team, and why you admire that so much.
So I'll give you two examples.
No, I can only have one. Well, I can invite you back again.
So example one is an organization. So it's almost it's an industry change story. So it's an organization that started out in Canada. And basically the founder of this company looked at what was happening in basically an unloved service sector. And so his business is called 1-800-GOT-JUNK. And 1-800-GOT-JUNK simply goes around to people's homes and removes old junk that they don't want, right? And when he started the business, he realized that people that were doing this type of work would turn up in an old beaten up van. They'd be in clothes that were ripped. They looked messy. They looked a bit untrustworthy. And ultimately, he thought, how do I, you know, almost start to build a business in this sector, but differentiate through a different level of standard? And so 1-800-GOT-JUNK grew basically around the idea of vans would always be polished and clean and well branded. Employees would always be uniformed. Shoes would always be shine. They'd always be polite. And they've absolutely dominated in this space. The interesting
thing... Where there's muck, there's brass.
And the interesting thing is that, you know, when you look at sectors, there are plenty of sectors where you would go, there is no opportunity there. But this company has kind of branched out into everything from, I think the latest idea is now house painting, right? And their holding company is simply called Ordinary to Extraordinary. And so how do you take an ordinary concept and differentiate it through extraordinary service?
And that's what everyone's looking for, right? And as the world becomes more leveled, yeah. Commoditized.
Yeah.
I love that story. And you can only have that one, though.
The second one.
No. Come back to you. Don't.
Over
to
you. So I've seen lots of different change over the time that... what I think about when you ask that question is what's the thing that makes a certain situation special and stand out? And I think there's a lot of serendipity involved in these things. It's timing and place and almost to some degree a bit of luck. But never missing is one key probably individual who inspires a bunch of people around them to go after a cause, which is growing a business or changing a business or inventing a business. And the degree of commitment that they put into it. There are no lazy great leaders. I mean, it's just not possible to do that. And, you know, the great leaders have great people with them. And I can't remember a single situation I've been involved in myself where the leader will not immediately, first when challenged, know why he's successful, will not turn around and say, it's not me, it's my team. And that's always been the situation that I've noticed. I've been privileged enough to work with such people.
So humility from the leader is key.
Almost a lack of awareness of their own strengths. Mm-hmm. And a liking and almost a love for the development of other people around them. And an admiration of achievement through what that team can achieve. Especially when they're taking on bigger companies or being the underdog or starting out in a fresh area. There's always a particular spirit about these situations that is very admirable.
Yeah. Well, that's a fabulous example, Doug. Thank you very much. So, Doug, Mark, that's been absolutely tremendous. You know, I'm sure our listeners have got some great insights from your experience in various transformations. And there's so much more we could talk about, I know, and we've only touched on a few of the topics. And you know, but we'll have you back. Will you come back?
100%.
Fantastic.
I'll be there.
Fantastic. Okay, we'll have you back. And that's all for now, folks. So thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode of the Predator Podcast.
Thanks, Al.
Thanks very much.